Joshua nodded to the assembly and then seated himself. The others quickly followed suit. As the pages came forward to pour wine, the old bishop at Joshua's left hand, Hernest Dears Gwythyn, sat on his right, rose.
"Please now,"
the bishop sounded sour, as a man who does a favor he knows will have no good result.
"Bow down your heads as we ask the blessing of Osiris Aidan on this table and its deliberation."
So saying, he lifted a beautiful tree of wrought gold and blue stones and held it before him.
"He who was of our world, but is not wholly of our flesh, hear us now. He who was a man, but whose father was no man, but rather the breathing God, give us comfort. Watch over this table and those who take seat here, and put your hand on the shoulder of him who is lost and searching."
The old man took a breath and glared around the table. Simon, straining to watch with his chin sunk on his breast, thought he looked as though he would like to take his jewel tree and brain the lot of them.
"Also," the bishop finished in a rush, "forgive those assembled for any damnable, prideful foolishness that might be spoken here. We are your children."
The old man teetered and dropped into his chair. There was a murmur of low conversation around the table.
"Would you guess, Simon, that the bishop is not happy to be here?"
Binnabik whispered. Joshua rose. "Thank you, Bishop, a notice for your heartfelt prayers. And thanks to all who come to this hall." He looked about the high, firelit chamber, left hand on the table, the other hidden in the folds of his cloak. "These are grave times," he intoned, moving his glance from one face to the other. Simon felt the warmth of the room well up in his, and wondered if the prince would say anything about his rescue. He blinked, opening his eyes in time to see Joshua's gaze slide quickly over him, and return to the center of the room. "Grave and troubling times. The High King in the Hayholt, and yes, he is my brother, of course. But for our purposes here, he is the king. Seems to have turned his back on our hardships. Taxes have been raised to the point of cruel punishment. Even as the land has suffered beneath fierce drought in Erkinland and Hernestir and terrible storms in the north. At the same time that the Hayholt reaches out to take more than it ever did under King John's reign, Elias has pulled back the troops that once kept the roads open and safe, and which helped to garrison the emptier lands of the Frostmarch and the Wealdhelm."
"Too true,"
shouted Baron Otmeyer, and clanged a flagon on the table.
"God bless you, but that's true, Prince Joshua."
He turned and waggled his fist for the benefit of the others. There was a chorus of agreement, but there were also others, Bishop Anodis among them, who shook their heads to hear such rash words so early on.
"And thus," Joshua said loudly, quieting the assembly, "thus we are faced with a problem. What are we to do? That is why I have called you here, and I presume why you have come. To decide what we may do. To keep those chains."
He lifted his left arm and showed the manacle still clasped there.
"Off our necks that the king would put on us."
There was a handful of appreciative cries. The buzz of whispered speech rose as well. Joshua was waving his enshackled arm for silence when there came a flash of red in the doorway. A woman swept into the room, long silk dress like a torch flame. It was she whom Simon had seen in Joshua's chambers, dark-eyed, imperious. Within moments she had reached the prince's chair, the eyes of the men following her with undisguised interest. Joshua seemed uncomfortable. As she bent down to whisper something in his ear, he kept his gaze fixed on his wine cup.
"Who is that woman?"
Simon hissed, and was not the only one asking, to judge by the rush of whispers.
"Her name is Vorsheva. Daughter of a clan lord of the Thrithings she is, as well as being the prince's—what? Woman, I suppose. They say she is of great beauty.
She is. Simon continued to stare for a moment, then turned back to the troll.
They say. What do you mean, they say? She's right there, isn't she? Ah, but I am having trouble judging.
He smiled.
It is that I do not like the look of tall women.
The Lady Vosheva had apparently finished giving her message. She listened to Joshua's reply, then a moment later glided swiftly from the hall, leaving only a final scarlet shimmer in the dark of the doorway. The prince looked up, and behind his placid face Simon thought he detected something that looked like embarrassment.
Now, Joshua began, we were... Yes, Baron de Vercellis.
The dandy from Naban stood up.
You were saying, Your Highness, that we should be considering Elias only as king. But that is obviously not true.
What do you mean? Asked the Lord of Naglamond, above a disapproving rumble from his liegemen.
Your pardon, Prince, but what I mean is this. If he were only king, we would not be here. Or at least Duke Leobardis would not have sent me. You are the only other son of Prester John. Where else would we travel so far? Otherwise those who had complaints with the Hayholt would travel to the San Kellen Magistrevis or to the Tague in Hernisadark. But you are his brother, yes? The king's brother?
A chilly smile flickered across Joshua's mouth.
Yes, Baron, I am,
and I understand your meaning.
Thank you, Highness.
De Vercellis made a small bow.
Now the question remains. What do you want, Prince Joshua? Revenge? The throne? Or merely an accommodation with a grasping king, one that will leave you unmolested here at the Naglamund?
Now there was a full-blown growl from the Erkinlanders present, and a few rose, brows beetling and moustaches quivering. But before any of them could seize the moment, young Gwythyn of Hernesteer leaped to his feet, leaning across the table toward Baron de Vercellis like a horse straining at the bit.
The gentleman from Naban wants a word, eh? Well, then here's mine. Fight! Elias has insulted my father's blood and throne, and has sent the king's hand to our Tague with threats and harsh words, like a man punishing children. We do not need to weigh the this and that of it. We are ready to fight.
Several people cheered the Hernesteerman's bold words, but Simon, looking fuzzily about the room as he finished the last drops of another cup of wine, saw even more looking worried, talking quietly with their table mates. Beside him, Binnebik was frowning, mirroring the expression that shadowed the face of the prince.
Hear me, Joshua cried. Naban, in the person of Leobardis' emissary, has asked hard but fair questions, and I will answer them.
He turned his cold stare to de Vercellis.
I have no wish to be king, Baron. My brother knew that. Yet still he captured me, killed a score of my men, and held me in his dungeons.
He brandished the arm shackle again.
For that, yes, I do wish revenge. But if Elias was ruling well and fairly, I would sacrifice the revenge for the good of Austin Ard, and especially my Erkinland. As to accommodation, I do not know if that is possible. Elias has grown dangerous and difficult. Some say that he crosses over into madness at times.
Who says?
De Vercellis asked.
Lord Suchef under his admittedly heavy hand? We speak of a possible war that will tear our nations like rotted cloth. It would be a shame if it started over rumors.
Joshua leaned back and summoned a page, whispering a message to him. The boy virtually flew out of the hall. A muscular bearded man in white furs and silver chains stood.
If the Baron remembers me not, I will remind him, he said, plainly uncomfortable. Aethelferth, Lord of Tynset, am I, and I wish to say only this. If my prince says the king has lost his wits, well, that word is good enough for me.
He furrowed his brow and sat. Joshua stood up, slender, grey-clad body uncoiling like a rope.
Thanks to you, Lord Ethelfirth, for your good words.
But, he cast his eyes around the assembly, which quieted to watch him, no one need take my word for anything, or the words of other of my liegemen. Instead, I bring to you one whose first-hand knowledge of Elias' ways you will, I am sure, find easy to trust. He waved his left hand toward the near door of the hall, the one through which the page had disappeared. The boy had re-entered. Behind him in the doorway were two figures. One was the Lady Vorsheva, the other, dressed in sky blue, stepped past Vorsheva into the pool of light around the wall sconce.
My lords, Joshua said, the Princess Miriamel, daughter of the High King.
And Simon, gaping, stared at the short, cropped strands of golden hair that showed beneath the veil and crown, shed of their dark disguise. And staring at the oh-so-familiar face, felt a great tumbling inside him. He almost stood as the others were doing, but his knees went watery and dropped him back into his chair.
How? Why?
This was her secret, her rotten, treacherous secret.
Maria, he murmured.
And as she sat in the chair, Gwythyn surrendered to her, acknowledging his gesture with a precise, gracious nod of her head. And as everyone else sat down again, talking aloud in their wonder, Simon finally lurched to his feet.
You,
he said to Binnebik, grabbing the little man's shoulder.
Did you know?
The troll seemed about to say something, then grimaced instead and shrugged. Simon looked up across the sea of heads to find Maria, Miriamel, staring at him with wide, sad eyes.
Damn,
he hissed, then turned and hurried from the room, his eyes pooling with shameful tears. Chapter 32 Northern Tidings.
Well, lad,
Towser said, pushing another flagon across the tabletop.
You couldn't be righter. Trouble they are. Always will be.
Simon squinted at the old jester, who suddenly seemed the repository of all knowledge. They write letters to a fellow, he said, and took a generous swallow.
Lying letters.
He set the cup back down on the wood and watched the wine wash from side to side, threatening to overtop the rim. Towser leaned back against the wall of his box-like room. He was in his linen undershirt and had not shaved for a day or two.
They do write those letters, he said, nodding his white bristled chin gravely. Sometimes they lie about you to the other ladies.
Simon frowned, thinking about it. She had probably done just that, telling the other high-born noble folk about the stupid scullion who had ridden with her on a boat down the Aelfwynt. It was probably a merry tale all through the Neglamund. He took another swig and felt the sour taste come back up, filling his mouth with bile. He set the cup down. Towser was struggling to his feet.
Look, look, the old man said, going to a wooden chest and rummaging about inside. Damnation! I know it's here somewhere. I should have realized,
Simon berated himself.
She wrote me a note. How could a serving girl have known how to spell better than me? Here's that god-be-cursed lute string,
Towser continued to rummage.
But Towser, she wrote me a note, said God bless me, called me friend.
What?
Well, that's fine, lad, fine. That's the kind of girl you want, not some stuck-up fancy lady who'll look down on you like that other. Ah, here.
Huh?
Simon had lost the thread. He was virtually positive. He had only been talking of one girl, the arch-traitoress, the identity-shifting Maria, Miriamel. Well, it didn't matter very much, did it?
But she fell asleep on my shoulder.
Fuzzily, drunkenly, he remembered warm breath on his cheek and felt a corresponding ache of loss.
Look at this, lad.
Towser was standing over him, swaying, holding out something white. Simon stared, puzzled.
What is it?
A scarf,
for cold weather. Do you see these?
The old man pointed a bent forefinger at a series of characters woven onto the white in dark blue thread. The shape of the runes reminded Simon of something that touched off a throb of cold inside him, even through the fog of wine.
What are they?
He asked, his voice a little clearer than before.
Remusgard runes,
the old jester said, smiling absently.
They read Croen, my true name. A girl wove the scarf for me, when I was with my dear King John at Elvrith's Hala.
Unexpectedly, he began to cry, feeling his way back to the table to slump down in the hard chair. Within a few moments the sobbing was over and water stood in his red-rimmed eyes, like puddles after a sun shower. Simon said nothing.
I should have married that one, Towser said at last, but she would not leave her land, wouldn't come back to the Hayholt. Frightened of foreign ways she was, frightened to leave her family. She died years ago, poor girl, he sniffed loudly. And how could I have ever left my good John?
What do you mean? Simon asked.
He couldn't remember where he'd seen the Rimmersgard runes lately, or at least he did not want to put out the effort to recall. Easier just to sit here in the candlelight and let the old man talk.
When were you in Rimmersgard?
He prompted.
Oh, lad, years and years and years.
Towser wiped his eyes without embarrassment and blew his nose into a capacious kerchief.
It was after the Battle of Narved. In the year after it was over, that was when I met the girl who made this.
What was the Battle of Narved?
Simon reached out to pour himself more wine, then thought better of it. What, he wondered, was going on in the Great Hall at this moment?
Narved? Towser goggled. You don't know Narved? Where John beat old King Jormgrin and became High King over the North.
I suppose I do know some of it, Simon said uncomfortably.
What a lot there was to know in the world.
It was a famous battle?
Of course.
Towser's eyes were bright.
John laid siege to Narved all through the winter. Jormgrun and his men never thought that southerners, Erkinlanders, could survive the cruel Rimmersgard snows. They were sure that John would have to call off the siege and retreat south. But John did it. Not only did they break Narved, but in the final storming, John went over the wall of the inner keep himself and got the portcullis open, held off 10 men until he could cut the guy rope. Then he broke Jormgrun's shield and cut him down before his own heathen altar.
Really? And you were there?
Simon had heard this story, more or less, but it was exciting to hear it from a first-hand witness.
As good as? I was in John's camp. He took me everywhere with him. My good old king.
How did Iskrimnor get to be duke?
Ah,
Towser's hand, which had been wringing the white scarf, went in search of the wine jug and found it.
It was his father, Isbeorn, who was the first duke, you see. He was the first of the pagan Remesgard nobles to become enlightened, to receive the grace of Osiris Aedhen. His house was made by John, the first house of Rimmersgard. So Isbeorn's son Eskrimnor is duke now. And a more pious Aedhenite you'd have a hard time finding.
What happened to King Jorg, whatever was his name, sons? Didn't any of them want to become Aedhenites?
Oh,
Towser waved his hand dismissively.
I think they all died in the fighting.
Simon sat back, pushing the confusing business of religion and paganism out of his mind, to try and visualize the great battle.
Did King John have Brightnail then?
He asked.
Yes, he did, Towser said. God's tree. He was a beautiful man to watch in battle. Brightnail. It shone so brightly and moved so quickly, just a blur of steel it was, that sometimes John looked like he was surrounded by beautiful, holy, silver light.
The old jester sighed.
So who was the girl? Simon asked.
Towser stared.
What girl?
The one who made the scarf for you.
Oh, Towser frowned, wrinkling. Sigmar.
He thought for several long moments.
Well, you see, we did not leave for almost a year. It's hard work administering a conquered country, you know. Hard work. Harder than fighting the damned war, it sometimes seemed to me. She was a girl who cleaned the hall, where the king stayed. Where I stayed, too. She had hair the color of gold. No, lighter. It was almost white. I lured her into me, just like taming a wild colt. A kind word here, a bit of extra food for her family there. Ah, she was a pretty one.
Did you want to marry her then?
I think I did. It's been many a long year, boy. I wanted to take her with me, that sure as sure, but she wouldn't go.
Neither spoke for a while. The storm winds moaned outside the thick castle walls, like hounds forgotten by their master. Candle wax dripped and sizzled.
If you could go back, Simon said at last, if you could be there again.
He struggled with the difficult idea.
Would you let her get away a second time?
There was no reply at first. Just when Simon was about to reach up and give a gentle shake, the old man stirred and cleared his throat.
I don't know, Towser said slowly. It seems as though God made happen what he meant to happen. But we must have choices, hey boy? Without choices, there's no good. I don't know. I don't think I want to unwrap the past that much. Better the way it is. Choices right or wrong.
But choices are so much easier afterward, Simon said, clambering to his feet. Towser stared fixedly into the wavering candle flame.
I mean, at the moment you have to decide on things, you never know enough. It's only later that you see everything.
He suddenly felt more tired than drunken, caught and tugged at by a wave of fatigue. He gave thanks for the wine, then said goodnight to the old jester, and walked out into the deserted courtyard and the slanting rain. Simon stood and knocked mud off his boots, watching Hasten stump away across the damp, wind-lashed hillside. The cook fires of the town below bled their smokes upward into the steely sky. Unwrapping the cloth padding from his sword, he watched the white blades of sunlight that thrust down through the clouds on the northwestern horizon, shafts that might signify either the presence of a brighter, better place beyond the storm, or only the impersonal play of light, caring nothing for the world or its problems. Simon stared upward, rolling the batting in his hands, but his mood remained unchanged. He felt lonely. Standing amid the swaying grasses, he might as well have been a stone or the stump of a tree. Binnebik had come by that morning, the sound of his rap at the door eventually cutting through Simon's wine-weighted sleep. He had ignored the rapping and the troll's faint words until both stopped, and he could roll back over and doze a little longer. He had no wish to see the little man quite yet, and had been grateful for the impersonal door between them. Hasten had laughed callously at the greenish tinge Simon wore to the guard barracks, and after promising to take him out sometime soon for some real drinking, proceeded to sweat the vapors out of him. Although at first Simon was convinced that his life was being drained from him at the same time, after an hour or so, he thought he could feel his blood once more begin to flow through his veins. Hasten worked him even harder than the day before, with cloth-shrouded sword and padded buckler. But Simon was grateful for the distraction.
It was a luxury to submerge himself in the relentless pounding rhythm of sword on shield, of swipe and dodge and counter-swipe. Now, with the wind knifing through his sweat-sodden shirt, he picked up his gear and started back up the slope to the main gate. Trudging across the rain-puddled inner courtyard, dodging the squad of guards in thick wool cloaks on their way out to relieve the sentries, it seemed to him that all the colour had been bled out of Naglamund. The unhealthy trees, the grey capes of Joshua's guardsmen, the priest's sombre vestments, every object in his view, could have been hewn from stone. Even the hurrying pages were only statues that had been given some sort of transitory life, but would eventually grind down into immobility again. As Simon toyed with, even enjoyed, these gloomy sentiments, his attention was attracted by a gleam of colour that suddenly appeared across a long, open courtyard, colours whose brightness leaped out like a trumpet call on a quiet evening. The extravagant silks belonged to three young women, who had swung out from an archway to skitter headlong, laughing across the open court. One wore red and gold, another a yellow like a field of mown hay. The third had a long, shiny dress of dove grey and blue. It took him only a fraction of an instant to recognize the last as Miriamel. He was already walking toward the retreating threesome before he knew what he was up to. A moment later he began to trot as they disappeared under the long columned walkway, the sound of their talk floating back to him like a provocative scent to a chained mastiff. Within 30 long paces, he had caught up. "Miriamel," he said. And it came out of his mouth very loudly, making him stop short in surprise and embarrassment. "Princess?" he lamely tacked on as she turned. Recognition was pushed off her face by another emotion that followed quickly behind, one that looked to him terrifyingly like pity.
"Simon?" she questioned.
But there was no corresponding doubt in her eyes. They stood 3 or 4 ells between them, facing each other as though across a canyon. For a moment they only stared, each waiting for the other's voice to cross the distance with the proper reply. At last Miriamel said something short and quiet to her two companions, whose faces Simon took no notice of, except to register what he was sure was disapproval in their expressions. The pair backed away, then turned and walked a short distance ahead.
I feel strange not calling you Maria, princess.
Simon looked down at the mud splattered on his boot tops, his grass-stained pants, and instead of the shame he would have expected, felt a kind of strange, fierce pride. Perhaps he was a bumpkin. At least he was an honest bumpkin. The princess looked him over quickly, saving his face for last.
"I'm sorry, Simon. I didn't lie to you because I wanted to, but because I had to."
She unknotted her fingers to make a brief gesture of helplessness.
"I'm sorry." "No, no need to be sorry. It just...
He searched for words, keeping his own hands resolutely clamped around his scabbard.
"It just makes things strange, I suppose."
Now he was looking her over. He decided that the beautiful dress, which he noticed was striped in green, perhaps in stubborn loyalty to her father, both added to the Maria he remembered and took something away as well. She looked good, he had to admit. Her fine, sharp features were now set like a valuable stone in a substance that showed them off properly. At the same time, there was something missing, something funny and earthy and careless in the Maria who had shared his river journey and the terrifying night on the Stela. There was not much to remind him of it in her subdued face. But a hint still lurked in the close-shorn strands of hair that showed at the neck of her cowl.
"Did you have your hair dyed black?" he asked at last.
She smiled shyly.
"Yes. I decided a long time before I ran away from the Hayholt what I needed to do. I cut my hair off. It was very long," she added proudly. "Then I had a woman in Urchester make it into a wig. Leleth brought it to me. I hid my cut hair beneath it, which was dyed black, so I could watch the men around my father unrecognized, hear things I wouldn't otherwise hear, find out what was going on."
Simon, despite his discomfort, was full of admiration for the girl's cunning.
"But why were you spying on me? I wasn't important." The princess continued to twine and untwine her fingers. I really wasn't spying on you, not the first time. I was listening to an argument my father had with my uncle in the chapel. The other times, well, I did follow you. I had seen you in the castle, on your own, no one telling you what to do, where to be, who to smile at and talk to. I was envious.
No one telling me what to do? Simon grinned in spite of himself. You never met Rachel the dragon then, girl? He caught himself. Princess, I mean.
Miriamelle, who'd been smiling too, again looked uncomfortable. Simon felt a surge of the anger that had burned in him all night. Who was she to be uncomfortable around him? Wasn't he the one who had plucked her out of a tree? Didn't she rest her head on his shoulder?
Yes. But that's a large part of the problem, isn't it? He thought.
I have to go. He hoisted the scabbard as though to show her some detail of its tooling. I've been sawing it all day. I'm sure your lady friends are waiting for you. He started to turn, then stopped and bent his knee to her. Her expression became, if anything, more discomforted, more sad than before. Princess, he said, and walked away. He did not look back to see if she watched him go. He held his head up, and his back was very straight. Binnebik, wearing what looked like his good clothes, a white deerskin jacket and a necklace of bird skulls, met him on his way back to the room. Simon greeted him coolly. He was secretly surprised to find that where there had been a vast store of anger only hours before, there now existed only a strange emptiness of spirit. The troll waited as he scraped more mud from his boots at the doorstep, then followed him into the room while he changed into the other shirt Strangyard had kindly left for him.
I am sure you are now angry, Simon, Binnebik began. I am wanting you to understand that I did not know about the princess until Joshua told me it the night before the last.
The priest's shirt was long, even on Simon's lank frame. He tucked it into his breeches.
Why didn't you tell me?
He asked, pleased with the light-headed, casual way he felt. There was no reason he should let the little man's bad faith trouble him. He had been on his own before.
It was because a promise was made.
Binnebik looked very unhappy.
I was agreeing before I knew to what. But it was only one day you did not know, and I did. Would there have been much difference made? She should have been telling you and me her own self. That is my thinking.
There was truth to what the little man said, but Simon did not like to hear Miriamelle criticized, even though he himself blamed her for vaster but more subtle crimes. It isn't important now, was all he said. Binnebik pulled a poorly formed smile.
I am hoping that is so. For now, the important thing is certainly the raid. Your story should be told, and I am thinking tonight will be the night. With your departure, you did not miss much, mostly Baron de Vaselis, looking for assurances from Prince Joshua, should the Navene be committing themselves to his side. But tonight...
I don't want to go. He rolled up the sleeves, which hung halfway down over his hands. I'm going to see Towser, or maybe Sangfukul. He fussed with a cuff. Is the princess going to be there? The troll looked concerned.
Who can say? But you are needed, Simon. The Duke and his Rimmersgardes are here. They have arrived less than an hour gone, cursing and dirty and with their horses blowing froth. There will be discussion of important things tonight.
Simon stared at the floor. It would be simpler just to find the harper and drink. It did seem to take one's mind off these kind of problems. Doubtless there would be some of his new guardsmen acquaintances who might be good company too. They could all go down to Naglamon Town, which he hadn't really seen yet. It would be so much easier than sitting in that great room, that heavy room, with the weight of decisions and danger upon them all. Let others do the discussing, the worrying. He was only a scullion, and had been out of his depth for too long. Wasn't that best, wasn't it? I'll go, he said finally, but only if I can decide whether I want to talk or not.
Agreed, said Binnabik, and offered a smile.
But Simon was not in the mood to dole one out in return. He pulled on his cloak, clean now, but bearing the unmended scars of the road and the forest, and let Binnabik lead him away toward the great hall.
This is it, shouted Ducas Grimnor of Elvrit's Hala. What more proof does anyone need? He will have all our land soon enough.
Iskrimnor, like his men, had not even taken time yet to shed his travelling clothes. Water drizzled from his sodden cloak, pooling on the stone floor.
To think that I once dandled such an unnatural monster on my lap.
He clutched his chest apoplectically, looking to his men for support. All but the expressionless, slit-eyed Einskaldir nodded their heads in bleak commiseration.
Duke! Joshua called out, raising his hand. Iskrimnor, please, sit down. You have been shouting since the moment you crashed through the door, and I still do not understand what...
What your brother the king has done?
Iskrimnor purpled and looked as though he might grab the prince and throw him over a broad knee.
He has stolen my land. He has given it to traitors, and they have imprisoned my son. What more would you have him do to be proved a demon?
The assembled lords and generals, who had leaped to their feet when the Rimmer's men came tumbling and shouting into the room, began to drop back into the hard wooden chairs, muttering angrily, steel sliding back into a dozen scabbards with a tuneful hiss.
Must I ask your man to talk for you, good Iskrimnor? Joshua asked. Or will you be able to tell us what has happened?
The old duke glared up the table at the prince for a moment, then slowly lifted his hand and drew it across his face as though to wipe away the sweat. For a dangerous moment, Simon felt sure that Iskrimnor would cry. The duke's red face crumpled into a mask of helpless despair, his eyes those of a stunned animal. He took a step backward and lowered himself into his seat.
He has given my land to Scarly Sharpnose, he said at last.
And as the bluster left Iskrimnor's voice, the hollowness rang clear.
I have nothing else and nowhere to go but here.
He shook his head. Aethelfirth of Tynset stood up, his broad face full of sympathy.
Tell us what happened, Duke Iskrimnor, he said. Here, we all share one grief for another, but we also share a long history of comradeship. We will be each other's sword and shield.
The Duke looked over to him gratefully.
Thank you, Lord Aethelfirth. You are a good comrade and a good northern man.
He turned back to the others.
Forgive me. This is disgraceful, the way I'm going on. It's also no damnable way to give news. Let me tell you of some things you should know about.
Iskrimnor picked up a stray wine flagon and drained it. Several of the other men, anticipating a long story, called for their cups to be refilled.
Much that has happened you will know, I'm sure, since Joshua and many others here were aware already. I told Elias I would not stay at his bidding in the Hayholt any longer. Not while blizzards killed my people and buried our towns, and while my young son must rule the Rimmer's men in my stead. The king had resisted me and resisted me for months, but finally said yes. I took my men and started north. The first thing was that we were ambushed at St. Hodorun's. Before we walked into the trap, the ambushers killed the keepers of that holy place.
Iskrimnor reached up and patted the wooden tree swinging against his chest.
We fought them, and they fled, escaping when we were slowed by a freakish rainstorm. I had not heard this, Devaselis of Navan said,
fixing Iskrimnor with a contemplative look.
Who ambushed you at the abbey?
I do not know, the Rimmersman replied, disgusted. Not a single prisoner could we take, although we sent a fair lot of them down the cold road to hell. Some of them looked like Rimmer's guarders. At the time, I was sure they were mercenaries. Now, I am not so quick to think I know. One of my relatives fell to them. Secondly, while camped not far north of the Nock, we were set upon by filthy Borken, a great hive of them, and on open ground, no less. A whole armed camp they attacked. We fought them off, too. But not without great losses. Hani, Thrinin, Uta of Sigurd.
Borken?
It was hard to tell if Devaseli's arched eyebrow was a sign of surprise or contempt.
Are you telling me that your men were attacked by the little people of legend, Duke Iskrimnor?
A legend in the south, maybe?
Einskaldi sneered from his seat.
A legend in the soft courts of Narbonne. In the north, we know them as real and keep our axes sharp.
Baron de Vercellis bristled, but before he would launch an angry reply, Simon felt a movement at his side, and a voice rang out.
Misunderstanding and ignorance, both north and south, are having in plenty,
Binnebik said, standing on his chair with one hand on Simon's shoulder.
The Borken, the diggers, are not extending their holes much past the northern borders of Erkinland. But what is good fortune for those farther south should not be mistaken for universal truth.
The Vercellis openly gaped in amazement, and he was not the only one.
And is this one of the Borken themselves come as emissary to Erkinland? Now I've seen everything under the sun and die happy.
If I am the strangest thing you see before a year is out,
Binnebik began, when he was interrupted by Einskaldir, leaping out of his seat to stand beside the startled Iskrimnor.
It is worse than a Borker, he snarled. It is a troll, a hellwite.
He tried to push past the Duke's restraining arm.
What is this stealer of babies doing here?
More good than you, you hulking and bearded idiot,
Binnebik snapped back. The assembly collapsed into general shouting and confusion. Simon grabbed the troll's waist. As the little man had leaned so far forward, he threatened to tumble onto the wine-stained table. At last, Joshua's voice could be heard above the clamor, calling angrily for order.
Aiden's blood, I will not have this! Are you men or children? Iskrimnor! Binnebik of Yukanuk is here by my invitation. If your man does not respect the rules of my hall, he may try the hospitality of a tower cell.
I wish an apology.
The prince tilted forward like a stooping hawk, and Simon, clutching Binnebik's jacket, was struck by the resemblance to the dead High King. Here was Joshua as he should be.
Iskrimnor bowed his head. I apologize for my liegeman, Joshua. He is hot-headed and not broken to courteous company.
The Rimmer's man turned a fierce look on Einskaldir, who sat down again, muttering silently in his beard, eyes cast to the floor.
Our people and the trolls are age-old enemies, the Duke explained.
The trolls of Yikanok are no one's enemy,
Binnebik replied, more than a little haughtily.
It is the Rimmersmen who are so frightened by our great size and strength that they attack wherever they see us, even in the hall of Prince Joshua.
Enough!
Joshua waved his hand in disgust. This is no place for the unstoppering of old bottles. Binnebik, you will have your say.
Iskrimnor,
you have a story yet to finish. De Vercellis cleared his throat.
One thing only let me say, Prince.
He turned to Iskrimnor.
Faced with the little man from Yikanuk, I find your story of Borken easier to credit. Forgive my doubting words, good Duke.
Iskrimnor's frown softened at the edges.
See nothing of it, Baron, he grumbled. I have forgotten it, as I'm sure you've forgotten Einskaldi's foolish speech.
The Duke paused for a moment to marshal his scattered thoughts.
Well, as I was saying, that was the strangeness of it all. Even in the Frost March and the Northern Wastes, the Buchan are scarce, and we are thankful to God it is so. For them to attack an armed force of our size is simply unheard of. The Buchan are small.
His gaze lit briefly on Binnebik and slid off onto Simon. Arrested, the Duke frowned again, staring.
Small. They are small, but fierce and dangerous when they attack in numbers.
Shaking his head as if to banish Simon's disturbing familiarity, Eskrimnor turned his attention back to the others gathered around the long, looping table.
After escaping the Hole Dwellers and making our way here to Naglimund, we quickly resupplied and headed north again. I was anxious to see my home again, and my son and wife. The Upper Wealdhelm Road and the Frostmarch Road are not good places these days. Those of you whose lands are north of here know what I mean, without any more talk needed. We were happy to see the lights of Vestvenby below us the night of the sixth day out. The next morning, we were met before the gate by Storfot, Thane of Vestvenby. What you would call a baron, I suppose, and a half-hundred of his housecarls. But had he come to welcome his duke? Embarrassed, and well he should be, the treacherous dog. He tells me that Elias has called me the traitor, and given my lands over to Scarly Sharpnose. Storfoot says that Scarly wants me to surrender myself, and he, Storfoot, will take me to Elvrit's Hollow, where my son Isorn is already being held, and that Scarly will be fair and merciful. Fair! Scarly of Coldskriker, who slew his own brother in a drunken brawl, would grant me mercy under my own roof? If my men hadn't held me back, if they hadn't.
Duke Eskrimnor had to stop for a moment, twisting his beard in fretful anger.
Well, he resumed, you may guess I was all for disemboweling Storfor on the instant. Better to die with a sword in my guts, I thought, than to bow to a pig like Scarly. But as Einskaldir pointed out, best of all will be to take back my hole and make Scarly eat steel.
Eskrimnor shed a brief, sour grin with his carl, then turned back to the assembly and slapped his empty scabbard.
So, that I promise. If I have to crawl on my old fat belly all the way to Elvrit's Hala, I swear by Dros Ham, by Osiris Aedhen, I mean, your pardon, Bishop Honoris. I will be there to put my good sword Kvalnir a yard into his guts.
Gwythyn, Prince of Hernestir, who had been unusually silent, now pounded a fist on the table. His cheeks were flushed, but not, Simon thought, just by wine. Although the young Westerner had been drinking that in plenty.
Good, the prince said. But see, Eskrimnor, see. It is not this Scarly who is your greatest enemy. No, it is the king himself.
A rumble went around the table, but this time it seemed mostly one of approval. The idea of having one's lands taken away and handed to a blood rival struck a deep and threatening spot in almost everyone.
The Hernestirman speaks rightly, shouted Fat Ordmer, heaving his bulk up from his seat. It is obvious that Elias only kept you at the Hayhold so long in order for Scarly to work his treachery. Elias is the enemy behind it all. As he has worked through his only two willing tools, Guthwulf and Fengbold and the others, to trample on the rights of most of you here.
Gwythyn had the bit in his teeth now, and he was pulling hard.
It is Elias who is reaching out to crush us all, until there is no resistance to the reign of misfortune, until the rest of us are taxed into poverty or ground beneath the heels of Elias knights. The High King is the enemy, and we must act.
Gwythyn turned to Joshua, overlooking the proceedings like a grey statue.
It is for you, Prince, to show us the lead. Your brother doubtless has plans for us all, as he has shown so clearly with you and Escrimnor. Is he not our true and most dangerous enemy?
No, he is not.
The startling voice cracked like a drover's whip through Naglaman's great hall. Simon, with every other soul in the room, whirled to see who had spoken. It was not the prince, who stood as baffled as everyone else. For a moment it seemed that the old man had materialized out of the insubstantial air. So suddenly did he step forward from the shadows into the glow of the wall sconce. He was tall, and almost impossibly spare. The torchlight cast deep shadows in the hollows of his cheeks and beneath the bony ridge of his brow. He wore a cloak of wolfskin, and his long white beard was tucked into his belt. To Simon he looked like some wild spirit of the winter forest.
"Who are you, old man?"
Joshua called. Two of his guards stepped forward to stand at either side of the prince's chair.
"And how do you come to be in our councils?"
"He is one of Elias' spies,"
hissed one of the northern lords, and others echoed him. Escrimnor stood.
"He is here because I brought him, Joshua," the duke growled. "He was waiting for us on our road to West Venby. Knew where we were bound, and knew before we did that we would return here. He said that one way or another he was coming to speak to you, and that it would only be better for everyone if I arrived as soon as was possible,"
the old man finished, fixing his luminous blue eyes on the prince.
"I have things of importance to tell you all."
He turned his disturbing gaze along the length of the table, and the whispering ceased in its wake.
"You may listen or not, that is your choice. That is always the choice in matters like these."
"These are children's riddles, man," mocked de Vercellis. "Whoever are you, and what do you know of the things we debate? In Narbonne," he smiled up at Joshua, "we would send this old fool to the Wildereven brothers, whose purview is the care of lunatics."
"We are not speaking of southern matters here, Baron,"
the old man said, with a smile cold as a row of icicles.
"Though soon the south, too, will feel chill fingers at its throat."
"Enough," Joshua cried. "Speak now, or I shall have you put in chains as a spy indeed. Who are you, and what is your business with us?"
The old man nodded stiffly.
"Your pardon. I am long out of practice with the ways of courts. Yarnauge is my name. Late of Tungoldir."
"Yarnauge?"
Binnabik said, climbing back onto his chair to peer at the new arrival.
"Amazing! Yarnauge! Oh, I am Binnabik. I was for long apprenticing with Uke Cook."
The old man pinned the troll with his bright steely eyes.
"Yes, we shall talk, and soon. But first I have business in this hall with these men."
He stood straight, facing the prince's chair.
"King Elias is the enemy, I heard the young Hernestiaman say, and I heard others echo him. You are all of you like mice, who speak in hushed tones of the terrible cat, and dream in the walls of doing away with him some day. Not a one of you realizes that it is not the cat who is the problem, but the master who brought him in to kill mice."
Joshua leaned forward, displaying reluctant interest.
"Are you saying that Elias himself is someone's pawn? Who? That devil Priorates, I suppose."
"Priorates presumes to deviltry,"
the old man sneered.
"But he is a child. I speak of one to whom the lives of kings are flitting moments. One who will take away far more than your lands."
The men began to talk among themselves.
"Has this mad monk broken in upon us to lecture us on the works of the devil?"
one of the barons cried.
"It is no secret to us that the archfiend uses men for his purposes."
"I do not speak of your Adonite master demon,"
Yanaga said, then turned his gaze back to the prince's tall chair.
I speak of the true, Master Demon of Austin Ard. Who is as real as this stone?
He squatted and slapped a palm on the floor. And as much a part of our land.
Blasphemy, someone shouted. Throw him out!
No, let him speak. Speak up, old man.
Yanaga raised his hands.
I am not some mad, half-frozen holy man. Come to save your imperiled souls.
He pinched his mouth in a bleak smile.
I come to you as one of the League of the Scroll, one who has lived his life beside, and spent that life watching the deadly mountain called Storm Spike. We of the League of the Scroll, as the Troll can confirm for you, have for long kept vigil while others slept. Now, I come to fulfill a vow made long ago, and to tell you things you will wish you had never heard.
A nervous silence fell over the hall as the old man walked across the room and pushed open the door that led to the courtyard. The howl of the wind, that had been only a dim moan, was loud in everyone's ears.
Yuvenmonth, Yanaga said. It is only weeks till midsummer. Listen, can a king, even the High King, do this?
A swirl of rain blew past him like smoke.
There are fur-clad Hunin giants, a hunting men in the Wield Helm, book and crawl from the cold earth to attack armed soldiers on the Frost March. And the forge fires of Storm Spike in the north burn all night long. I myself have watched the glow against the sky and heard the icy hammers